You're listening to episode 333 of the Building Psychological Strength podcast. I'm your host, Dr. April Seifert. On this podcast, we uncover the information, tools, and techniques to turn our mind into our most valuable asset. Hey everyone, welcome back to this episode of the podcast. I'm Dr. April, and I am so thrilled that you're here. You know, quite often, I find myself digging around on Amazon, looking at fun books that have either come out or are about to be released, and I'll come across books whose authors are incredible, who I absolutely need to get on the podcast. And that happened recently, which is how this week's episode came to fruition. Specifically, I was out on Amazon and I discovered the book titled The Trouble with Passion: How Searching for Fulfillment at Work Fosters Inequality. It was such an interesting title, I had to dive in. And I especially was curious about this because of the word passion. So many of us have been told to follow our passion, that we should do work that we are passionate about, and that if we aren't passionate with our jobs, something's wrong. We're living in the context right now where the great resignation, quote unquote, is happening, where people are leaving their jobs. They are not taking employment in certain industries or in certain types of jobs. And we're seeing a big reshuffling of how work gets done, by whom, and all of the parameters and assumptions around it. And this notion of passion was important there because so many times I've read countless blog articles from researchers and people who are really great thinkers who are pointing to the fact that, oh, people aren't finding passion and meaning in their work as the reason why this great resignation is taking place. So I knew I needed to reach out to the author of the book. Her name is Erin Seck, and I wanted to see what she had to say about all of this, and that's where this week's episode came from. A couple quick bits of info on our guest. Erin Seck is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Michigan, and her research, including the incredible amount of research that went into the book that I just mentioned, it investigates how seemingly benign and taken for granted cultural beliefs reproduce workforce inequalities. So we're going to be talking about passion in that way today, but also there's a really cool connection here to life design. So the Stanford University Life Design Lab recently, or in the past handful of years, released a book called Designing Your Work Life, and they make a similar point to what Erin, this week's guest, makes, and that is that our job is only one small portion of our lives, and we shouldn't look only to our job as our source of fulfillment, our source of passion, our source of expression and creativity, our source of identity. And Erin, and frankly, Stanford, their life design lab, gives some incredible takeaway points, some incredible tips for how you can find more passion, even if it isn't necessarily coming from your job, and how you can protect yourself from some of the things that we're going to talk about on this week's podcast episode. So this was one that I absolutely could not miss doing. I absolutely had to go get her to be on the podcast, and I'm so thrilled that I did. So hang out for a second, and we'll be right back with this amazing discussion with Erin Seck. Erin, I'm so excited that you're joining us for this episode because given everything that has been going on in our work lives and all of the tentacles that we're finding our work lives have into the rest of our lives, this is a very timely conversation. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, April.
All right. So you wrote a book called The Trouble with Passion: How Searching for Fulfillment at Work Fosters Inequality. What made you write a book about passion?
I wouldn't have written the book had the data not hit me upside the head. So I was a postdoc at Stanford University, and I was interviewing college students about why they were choosing their major and what they wanted to do after graduation. And I kept hearing the same narrative over and over again, that the best way to make a career decision, both in what people wanted to do for their major and also what they wanted to do down the line, was to follow your passion. And I was interested in these interviews initially because I wanted to understand gender differences in career decision making and why we have such persistent occupational gender segregation in college majors as well as in after college. And it was so interesting because I heard the same narrative among most men and women. And it's just that the things that they ended up being passionate about led them to different kinds of fields. And so I stepped back and I said, you know, what is the academic literature on this idea of passion seeking? Because if you look at the literature on the labor force and on economic sociology, the conversation is really about people prioritizing financial success, economic stability, and very little about these other things that seem to be important in terms of what people are thinking about with their jobs. And so that led me to really want to center this idea of passion seeking in this book and really walk around it and ask several hard questions about what it means to pursue our passion and what happens when we do.
That's really interesting. And I mean, I saw the title of your book and I was instantly curious and reached out to you directly like, hey, you need to come on this podcast because we need to have this conversation. Some of the context around this and podcast episodes hang out in, I don't know, in perpetuity, forever, it seems like there's a long tail on them. So just to set the stage, depending upon when you're listening to this, we are currently, at the time of recording this, we're at the end of 2021. This is likely going live beginning of 2022. But at this time, we're hearing about the great resignation, the great reshuffling. There's all these conversations around, holy cow, the pandemic's been going for nearly 2 years now. Everybody's quitting their jobs and there's this big shuffle and no one can get people to work in certain industries and types of jobs. And there's a big conversation happening right now about why is everyone leaving and why is everyone moving around? I'd love to hear. I mean, you've been in this situation, you've read the research and have lived through this context that I just described. What's your take on all of that?
Yeah, it's so interesting because my book was ready to be published in the beginning of the early middle part of the spring of 2020. Mm. And I contacted my publisher and I said, we got to put the brakes on this because I don't know what's going to happen to the idea of passion seeking after the pandemic. What people have come to think about their jobs and their relationships with their work could be completely upended in a way that the book I had written in the past isn't necessarily going to be consistent with what's going ahead in the future. And so I refielded the entire core survey of the book in October 2020 because I wanted to know if passion is important at this time when there's so much instability and insecurity, it likely is consistent to be something that's going to stick around for a long time. And I found that the passion principle, this idea of finding our passion as a guide for our career paths, was extremely robust, just as robust as it was in 2020, as I found it was in 2018. But what was so interesting is that the people who had actually experienced some kind of job instability or furloughing, these are college educated workers in particular, folks who had experienced that were actually more likely to be invested in the idea of passion seeking than people whose jobs have remained stable. And that suggests to me that there is this space of deep existential insecurity that comes along with the economic and financial instability and insecurity with employment instability in the pandemic. And so that really makes sense with what's going on broadly with the Great Resignation at this moment, where people are thinking really critically about not only how much am I getting paid and can I get better benefits or better rewards from my employer, but rather, what does it mean for me to be a worker and how do I want to see myself as a participant in the labor force?
That's so interesting. And it came about, I think you're totally right. And it came about in such an interesting way as we all, frankly, I think a big driver of this is that we all took the biggest, somewhat of a pause, maybe, you might've been in a situation, depending upon who you are listening to this, you might've been in a situation where you were still working, whatever. But when that big upheaval happened, there was still, even if it's just a mental pause or taking stock of what's happening, we all just completely shifted our patterns, which can put us into this mindset where we start to question things that we haven't before. We look at things that were assumptions that we believed were rules, facts, laws, and we find out that in fact, there's some weaknesses there. We were joking before we hopped on to record that if anything, the pandemic at this point, again, almost 2 years in, has exposed every even somewhat weak assumption that we had across all of our institutions, all of our practices, and work is one of those situations. I'm curious about when you digging into the findings that you found around passion and people who are experiencing instability. Can you talk a little bit more about what your research found with that? Like, who is it that follows their passion more or is more interested in it? And then what's the outcome as a result of that?
Sure. So among the college educated workers that I interviewed as well as surveyed, there was actually relatively little difference in the commitment to the idea of passion seeking by sociodemographic characteristics. So women were a little bit more likely to be invested in passion seeking than men were. White workers were slightly more likely to be invested than African American and Asian workers were. And those who had more of a high, wealthy socioeconomic background were slightly less likely to be invested in passion seeking than those from lower income, working class, middle class backgrounds. But for the most part, for every demographic group that I looked at, the idea of prioritizing finding meaning and fulfillment at work was seen as not only important to their broad sort of abstract sense of what it meant to have good work, but also in the way that they thought about their own career path and prioritizing their own career path. And I also talked to college students. I interviewed 100 college students at three universities, seeking to understand this in a much more in-depth way for people who are at the cusp of joining the white-collar labor force. And I found similarly that there was little variation in attachment to the idea of following their passion. But one of the most striking findings of the book, and one of the biggest troubles with passion, is that people are not equitably set up for success in terms of their ability to follow their passion.
Oh, let's double click in there. Tell me a little bit more about that. I'm so curious because that gets to the crux of the title of your book. I would love to learn more about what you found there.
Yes. So if we tell somebody to follow their passion, the assumption with that is that as long as they put in the hard work and dedication that aligns with their sense of passion for the work, that they will succeed. It presumes that the labor force, that college in general operates meritocratically, and that as long as you put in the time and put in the effort, you will succeed. But we know, stepping back, that there's a lot of differences in who is able to get decently paying stable employment in the work. And so what I find is that even if lower income and wealthier students were just as likely to be interested in seeking their passion after graduation, those who were from wealthier families had springboards and safety nets to be able to parlay their passion into some kind of gainful employment. And so those, the springboards were things like connections that their parents might have had to other people in industry that they could connect their kids to, safety nets for things like financial support to pay their rent while they sought out jobs that were aligned with their passion, and a general sense of like understanding how to navigate the professional labor force. We're all varied by socioeconomic background. And so what I found is that when undergrad students left college and sought out their path in the labor force, those from wealthy backgrounds were pretty successful in being able to launch into something that was both in their passion and was stable and secure compared to students from lower class backgrounds, as well as first gen students. They were much more likely to end up in a job that not only was precarious, that was low paid and unstable, but also was far outside of their passion.
That's so interesting. My mind's going in a lot of directions, but one thing that I want to bring up right away is the mindset or the psychological side of what you just mentioned. So I've been an entrepreneur for a while now. And it is difficult to overstate the impact that something like confidence and feeling safe and the ability to take on risk has in your ability to be successful. It's difficult to start a business and be successful at it unless you have some degree of optimism that it's going to work out, that you feel like you can safely, I'm not going to say necessarily comfortably always, because I mean, there have been many a nights that I'm like, I'm digging an ulcer right now. This is bad. But from a basic needs standpoint, that you can safely take on risk, that's a very different standpoint. Like, at no point in my journey personally have I ever questioned whether I was going to be able to put food on the table during my entrepreneurial journey. That is an incredible place of privilege to be able to take a risk and say, you know what, I'm not going to make any money for 6 months this year because I'm investing in some space in my business and I need that cash to go somewhere else and not to pay myself. That is an incredible point of privilege that allows me to take a risk that then pays off and helps me grow my business. And so if you take that sort of entrepreneurial blah, blah, and parlay it into what we're talking about in a career, you have a similar situation here where your comfort level, and I'm not going to say you're going to feel 100% comfortable. So, you know, I get it. If you're still afraid, I get it. If you still feel like an imposter all the time, I get it. But the basic needs piece that you're talking about, the most fundamental, can I feed my family? Can I keep a roof over my head? Am I safe? Those things can get in the way, and I can imagine become a massive factor in deciding whether you have the luxury or what feels like the luxury to go pursue a passion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's a couple of pieces here that are important to note. One is that students and young career aspirants who are, you know, seeking their place in the labor market, or even people who are doing some kind of career change like you articulated, don't necessarily see the resources they have available to them or not, and make decisions along those lines. It's often a sense of like, I'm going to dive in and see what happens. And the people who succeed are often the ones who have those resources. But when we step back, the narrative of the passion principle is so seductive to us culturally. We often tell the story about people like Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, maybe you, April, of being able to be successful in following your passion, not as they were able to put in the hard work to do the thing they were interested in and had these other resources, but rather they were just so passionate about it, they were able to succeed regardless.
As though it in a vacuum is what's doing it.
Exactly. And it's a process that I call choice washing in the book. This idea that we take something that is inherently structural, inherently part of inequitable processes and patterns of resources, and we explain it as the result of individual choice making. In this instance, individual passion seeking and the hard work that aligns with it.
There's so much to that too. We do that in so many aspects of life and decision-making. We sort of discount how many situational factors helped facilitate or helped influence a particular outcome, or whether we even considered a path as one that was available to us. And what I love about it, about the way that you just described this, is it's a problem of and. It's like, sure, somebody might have passion and there was hard work there and there was a set of facilitating springboards that you would call them. And so nobody is saying you didn't work hard, you whatever. It's an and piece, that the more of these ands you have, you can see where it would catalyze you and sort of grease the wheels to help you go a bit further, be more likely to be successful, because you've got more of that lift underneath you helping to propel you.
Right. And but there's also pieces that are kind of structural and societal in the passion part of that and. So when we think about the things that we're passionate about, those are things that we find fulfilling and self-expressive, and those seem to us to be inherently individualistic. They belong to us, they're unique to us, and they are something that we continually work on and refine over the course of our lives. But we know that identities are deeply patterned by things like our gender, our race, ethnicity, our class, our nationality. And so when we go and align our life choices with our passion, when we go and find work that we're passionate about that aligns with our self-expression, we often reproduce the same patterns of gender segregation and race segregation and class segregation that exists to have structured our sense of identity in the first place. And another piece of that that's so important is that when people pursue their passion and aren't successful for whatever reason, because of the choice washing that happens with passion seeking, they often blame themselves. They can't see the structural barriers that made it more difficult for them to succeed. They take it on as their own personal failing at pursuing their passion.
Because we say that, yes. Right? Like, we, especially in the US, have such an individualistic view of people. We see, and again, it goes back to what you said before, right? My success is mine. I don't have to point to the contextual factors. This was all me. I must not have worked hard enough. And there are a million factors that can influence that. I mean, at a micro level, I heard somebody say the neatest thing recently. They said, don't confuse, and this is ancillarily related, but worth bringing up. They said, don't confuse the quality of your decision with the quality of the outcome that it generated. It's sort of like shooting an arrow. The decision is the point where you pull the arrow back and you let it go. The bird that flies in and hits the arrow off course or whatever, on the gust of wind or whatever, outside of your control. So you may have worked your tail off. You may have made great decisions, but these circumstances that happen contextually also are part of that picture, for better or worse. You know, they can either help facilitate or they're helping to hold down. But either way, I see the cyclical nature of these forces that create our sense of identity, which then fuels us to make choices that align to it. It's so interesting and happens without us even realizing. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So it's an interesting thing to think about that from our own individual situations, right? Like me, April, I made career decisions based on what I found interesting. This is my individual life trajectory. Let's expand that out though. So now we've got millions of people who are doing, now we've got like a trend, right? We've got like a societal movement and effect that we can see at a larger scope. What does this mean for how work happens and some of the results that we see on a broader societal scale? What are the results of this?
What's so interesting about something, as you said, that's at the individual level is it's sort of more than the sum of its parts. So yes. The idea that you have individual people who are pursuing their passion, who are identifying the place in their labor, in the labor market, that sort of brings them joy and brings them a sense of fulfillment. And if you have, you know, many, many people, a large percentage of the population, or even, you know, even a quarter, even a third of the population thinking about work in that way, that actually fuels the notion of overwork and the expectations for overwork, especially in the white collar labor force. So if you are a startup company and you're seeking to hire a new computer programmer and you have two applicants, one that expresses interest in the company and the location where the company is based, and one that expresses interest in the work because they're passionate about it, most employers actually will choose the passionate applicant because they presume they will put in more effort for the same amount of pay. And that's actually what I found in an experiment that's part of the book. So I had people review job applications and to indicate whether or not they'd be interested in hiring the applicant and why they were interested in hiring them or not. And what I found is that not only did employers see that they would benefit from having somebody who was passionate about their work, but that it would be something that could be potentially exploited. They would get more work out of the worker without an increase in compensation. And there was no difference in the salary that were offered to the passionate versus the non-passionate person. They didn't get a premium on their wages for their passion.
Like a passion kicker on top of your salary. Yeah, that's interesting because there's two sides of the coin. Like I can feel where people's minds are going. Well, but of course, if I was hiring somebody, I would want somebody who's going to work hard. I would want somebody who's going to work, you know, like stay a little bit longer so they could get that little bit extra done or solve that additional problem or whatever the case may be in your industry. I would want that. That's one side of the coin. If you flip that coin over though, all of us, I would venture a guess to say the word all, many, most, have been in a situation where you've worked at a job where you look around and you're like, I want to go home and no one's going home. Like everyone stays till six. Why are you staying till six? I want to go home. Like I want to be done with my day. Or the bookends of our day creep earlier and earlier and later before you're coming in at like seven and staying until six. And this is, and we saw this happen and get magnified with the pandemic when we lost our commutes and white collar office work, sort of knowledge worker situations. That I would urge you to think about the two sides of the coin. Again, yes, if you put your individual hiring manager, CEO, startup hat on, yeah, sure, you may feel the urge to hire that person, but the societal impact that it has, as you're suggesting, is here we are in a situation where now it's this self-propagating thing where we all think we have to stay later to keep up with the person who's like uber passionate and just would live there if they could.
Exactly. And I think with employers, there is an argument to be made that when people are overworked, they're not as productive. They don't produce as good or as high quality or creative outcomes. So that's not necessarily something that is beneficial to have someone that is so passionate about their work that will keep doing it to the point of overwork. But for the individual people who are passionate about their jobs, I think that there are a couple of risks that are important to note here. One is the potential for one's work to be exploited or take advantage of by one's employer. And so that might be addressed by taking stock of the way that you're contributing to your job, and that is beyond what your job description is, making that visible to your employer, asking for compensation or recognition of that additional labor you're doing in the space of passion rather than as part of the job description. But beyond that, the risk is that if we invest so much of our time and energy in the work that we're doing, and we don't have time to really find meaning outside of work, that is investing a tremendous amount of our sense of identity and sense of fulfillment in a place that wasn't designed to support that. The labor force is not the platform to help us nurture and develop our sense of selves, our sense of identity. That's not what was designed for many other things than that. And so we put such an important part of ourselves in the hands of an institution that could very rarely and often will not take care of that. So, for example, there's been instances of different academic departments that have been dissolved or closed in some capacity over the last 10 years. And my colleagues and I in sociology, and I've talked to colleagues in other disciplines as well about what this feels like to them. And the concern is not necessarily, it is in part, I'm going to lose my job and I'm not going to have a paycheck. But even more so, it's, I'm going to lose a part of my identity if this department closes. What happens if I can't be a professor anymore? And that suggests that we need to step back and rethink where we're finding meaning in our lives.
I totally agree. I want to go down that rabbit hole. I want to make one point before we do. I had this conversation with several times in different capacities. I do a lot of speaking for larger like corporate events. And I was speaking to a very large company recently about this exact topic around how interwoven our identity with our job becomes. And there's a lot of reasons for that, a lot of reasons for that. But this happens even outside of a situation, and this parlays onto a conversation with that I had with my husband. He said, imagine me, he's an ER physician. So talk about some privilege for starting your own business. Like, I'm fine. It's fine. Right. Gave me some serious traction there. But anyway, he was talking about how he sees it in his profession because your literal title changes when you graduate. People who just meet you. Oh, it's Dr. Joy is his last name. And you become a whole different person. Similarly with a professor, you inherit that prefix to your name. But I would argue, Joe manager at whatever company, if you go to a social event, one of the first questions people will ask you is, what do you do? And you respond with a very identity Mad Libs kind of answer. Oh, I am the insert your title of insert your department at insert your company. We wear that like it is like a fingerprint. And I also know this to be true because when I exited the normal workforce and I became a quote freelancer, quote entrepreneur, self-employed person, I had a identity crisis. I'm like, who am I? I'm whoever I write down on my business card. Okay, I'm the high priestess of data science. Like, I could literally name myself anything. Vistaprint would put it on a business card and that was it. And I'm like, that's not legitimate. And it occurred to me, it doesn't matter. Someone's making up everyone's title. None of this is legitimate. That was crazy. But the crisis and the weight that shedding carried was insane. I couldn't believe it. So this happens to everyone, regardless of whether you have a postgraduate degree or you're one of the five jobs that you knew existed when you were 4 years old or anything. It happens to all of us. It gets so all-consuming. And then therefore, our job, to your other point, and this is the rabbit hole I want to go down, becomes everything to us. We forget that we have lives, not just a job. So I would love for you to go there, like talk a little bit about what you're finding in terms of like people who are focused solely on their job as the be all end all of just fulfilling them in all of these ways.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, to your point, that pressure to identify ourselves with their job starts way earlier. We ask kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? And we expect an occupation as the answer to that. Yeah. Not, as I say in the end of my book, I want to be kind, or I want to be a good neighbor or a good parent or a community organizer, right? In the US society generally, we tend to conflate a sense of self with an occupation. And that's dangerous for a whole host of reasons. But for those individuals who their job is their whole life, and these aren't necessarily the people who are in the trenches of something that they're in the grind, they don't love it, but they see it as an opportunity, as a springboard to something else in their career. And they're sort of doing it to get the experience and move on. But people who are in their job, they're loving it, they're passionate about it, and they're working 60, 70, 80 hours a week, more than that often for many. Mm-hmm. The concern there is you just don't have time to find other places to find meaning. And the importance for people like that, how I call it in the book, is the importance of diversifying your meaning-making portfolio. And that is, you know, how can I make space in my life for things that I am passionate about that aren't tied to my work, that give me a sense of fulfillment, that give me a sense of identity, so that if and maybe when my job disappears or all of a sudden things change at my organization and the job wasn't what it was before, that I don't have an anchor for my sense of identity anymore. And I have to say that takes work to make room in your life for things that are not your work to be passionate about. As I've been going through the journey of thinking about this topic of writing this book, it was a hard thing for me. I am very invested, dare I say, passionate about these issues of workforce inequality. And so I spent nights and weekends working on this research. And as I was going through understanding the implications and the tentacles of the consequences of passion seeking in lives of individuals and in sort of collective issues, I had to come to terms with my own self and the way that I was using my time. And so I had to be really conscientious about saying, I'm going to stop work at this time, and I'm going to go do the thing that I newly find passion for, painting, or pick up my violin that I used to be passionate about when I was in high school and relearn how to do that there. But it takes time and it takes effort to do that. It's not something that's necessarily easy or comes naturally to a lot of folks who are so invested and so passionate about their jobs.
I love this discussion because the audience that follows this podcast, you know, regularly knows what a love affair I have for the Stanford University Life Design Lab and the work that they do to help people be more intentional about their full lives. But one of their more recent books is called Designing Your Work Life. And they make a point that's very similar to yours, where they talk about three needs. Now, these are not the only human needs, but they highlight three. One is financial security, one is impact, and one is expression or like creativity. And so many times in the US, to the point that you've been making, we look to our job to be the be-all end-all of all three of those things. And it's true that as a human, if you had three cups, you know, of each representing one of those things, you need to have those cups full, but you're going to one place in your life in order to fill all of them. And that might be unreasonable. And if you think about job dissatisfaction, you're looking at those three cups and you're saying, I'm dissatisfied with my job because it's not being all these things to me. And it's funny because the analogy that I used when I was speaking with this larger corporate client was, I said, imagine the people, your support system in your life, right? So for me, I've got my husband, I've got my best friend, and I've got my brother. I'm going to highlight those three people. There are things that each of those people are uniquely great at. And I'm going to pick on my husband right now. I'm sorry, Jeremy. Dr. Joy. Anyway, I'm going to pick on him right now. Poor thing. He's used to it. He is exceedingly good at problem solving. He's an ER physician. He can do it like it's just so easy. His brain works that way. He's not great at holding space for an emotional problem that I don't want solved right now. I just want to chew on it a little bit. I'm not ready. He can't do that. My best friend can do that. But if I look to my husband to be the be-all end-all of all of the social support that I need, I'm going to be dissatisfied with him instead of recognizing what his role is in that whole web, going to him in the appropriate ways and filling those other cups up with the people who are able to do that or are more skilled or more naturally do that. And I love that, like, my empathetic holding space is your violin or painting. Like, we have lives and other places we can go to fill those cups up, but we don't. And we sort of repeat the cycle of focusing only on our jobs. And I'm like, I have to get this woman, because this message needs to be out that people's lives are broader, but there's important things there. And I want you to drill this home a little bit more. There are expectations and other forces, to your point, working 80 hours a week, you don't have time to do those things that would need to change in order for us to do that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So that's an issue with the post-industrial labor market generally, and in the US in particular, that there is the expectation that if you are a salaried employee, you are not putting 40 hours a week in, you're putting 60, 70, 80 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And so this expectation for work devotion, which it's often called in sociology, is really strong. But what that does is it not only sets the expectation for professionals to do their work as though they were passionate about it, but that gets implanted onto service sector workers, blue collar workers, those without a college degree, and the kind of work that they're expected to do. One of the things that's so striking to me is once you look for it, you can see it all over. But for example, Starbucks placards advertising sort of on the street will often talk about the passion of their baristas to serve their customers. And so that's not just being kind to the people coming in the door, being considerate to the customer. It's about performing passion for coffee, performing passion for making this latte for somebody, right? And that is an extra kind of labor. It's not just the work of being nice. It's not just the work of physically making the latte, but it's a performance of a sense of identity with the making of that latte that can be so exploitative and so exhausting for the people who are positioned in it. And so if we take a step back and say, what do we do with all of that? It's not just that we have to get professional workers to say, okay, wait a minute, let me take a step back from work devotion. Let me take a step back and try and make space in my life for work. This is about pointing out and changing the things that make the labor force so precarious and problematic for everyone, regardless of whether or not they have a job that they might even be remotely passionate about. And that requires collective solutions. That requires us to have the ability for people to come together and demand better treatment, better hours, better pay, better working conditions, more predictable hours, better leave opportunities, all those things that we have been talking about ways to make the labor force less unstable, less precarious, less awful for so many workers, are just as important for thinking about how to undermine the issues that are brought up with the prominence of the passion principle.
This is so good. I seriously think we could talk for like 4 hours about this, because I have a million rabbit holes that I'm really struggling hard to jump over, because I know that it's going to launch us into a 4-hour podcast. I would love to, actually, before I go there, I want to make one point. This brings us back to what we're seeing happening right now with this resignation, reshuffling. You know, I think age-wise, I'm about to turn 42. Maybe when this comes out, I'll have just turned 42, depending upon timing, beginning of January. And I maybe technically fall into Gen X, but because I went to grad school, I entered the workforce kind of in the middle of the millennial workforce, right? Generation. And it was interesting when that happened, because there was this big backlash against the millennial generation at the time. And you hear it continuing with Z and et cetera, that look how disloyal they are. They're not loyal to their company. And it was interesting, because I had been told and had heard what a lot of people heard: go to school, get a degree, go get a good job, stable job, stay at it. Don't jump around. It looks bad on a resume. Stay there. But something happened. I entered the workforce and I didn't go into academia. I went into a typical 9-to-5-ish, whatever, quote unquote, 9-to-5 knowledge worker job. people got laid off every 18 months, massive layoff every 18 months. And I was like, hold on, like, hang on. What abusive relationship is this that I'm supposed to be loyal, but then you're going to lay me off every 18 months? Like, what? And that's part of the reason why freelancing and entrepreneurship was interesting to me. Cause I was like, it's the same. We're just being really honest about it. So you tell me you're going to work for me for 6 months and then we're going to cut ties and I'm going to stop paying you. And I'm like, cool, let's ink that contract. And then I tell you, here's what I'm willing to do for those 6 months. And this is what it costs. Are we cool? Yes. And if you go over that, I'm going to charge you for it. Unless I'm, you know, maybe doing it out of the goodness of my heart to score more business. Like it's a business development, you know, opportunity. But typically, like, this is about as crystal clear above board as you can get. I'm like, I will work for this amount of time and then I will be fired and I will charge you more if you ask me to do things that are outside of the scope. And it was interesting because we're seeing that happen, I think, more globally, like the backlash to, I will not work those extra hours. I will not put up with that, you know, a person who is an HR nightmare. I'm not going to be in these conditions and give up so much. We're seeing it happen broadly. And I'm looking at this great resignation going, I don't think it's that confusing that we're seeing this. It actually makes a ton of sense.
Absolutely. It's an opportunity that we have rarely ever had, at least in the last 3 or 4 decades, for workers to say, we might have a little bit more power than we had in the past, to be able to articulate to our employers what we need from them, what we need from our work, and what we are and are not going to be willing to tolerate. I think the thing that I'm a little bit concerned about is that these are still more individual level actions, where individual workers are negotiating with individual organizations for change. And really, for us to take advantage of this moment, these have to be more collective conversations and spaces of collective action.
So let's go there then. Let's go with one, like a tip that you might have or a starting place. One thing individually, if you are struggling with this passion thing, we've got individual people who are listening to this, what would you advise them to do? And then societally, what's the big thing that you would love to see shift if we could do something on that global, more macro scale?
So at the individual level, as I was saying, diversify your meaning making portfolio. Think hard about how tied you are to your job and what might happen to your sense of identity if that job, like it happened to you, disappeared overnight. How would you cope? What would that mean to you? And how can you find other anchors in your life of that sense of identity? More collectively, I think all movements that allow us to increase the social safety net for workers are really important and really powerful. But I would say if I could wave a magic wand and make one very concrete thing, it would be reducing student loan debt. So, for example, I had a student that I spoke to, really passionate about music education, first-gen student, had over $70,000 of student loan debt after leaving college, went and started his music lessons business, was passionate about it, was actually really successful getting clients, but he couldn't get on top of his student loan payments fast enough. And so he had to leave his passion to go work at a UPS warehouse for a little bit more money than he was paying. So he was outside of his passion in something totally misaligned with the thing he was trained in because he didn't have the social safety nets that his peers had in terms of parental help in paying for his college.
That's awesome. I love both of those. What, as we're wrapping up, I have to ask you something I ask everybody. What's your definition of psychological strength?
I think psychological strength is the ability to face challenges and take risks in one's life alongside a deep commitment to grow and to fail and do hard things, but to trust in oneself to be able to kind of climb up out of that and be okay.
Erin, you're so awesome. This was such a great conversation. There's so much more we could say behind it. There's such great research behind it. Where can people connect with you? Where can they get your book if they're interested?
Excellent. The book, The Trouble with Passion, is available at most online retailers, Amazon, indie books, etc. And you can find me on Twitter at at SecErin, SecErin.
Amazing. We'll link both of those things up in this episode description and on your show notes page. Erin, I'm so glad that we were able to set this up and that you were with us today. This has been fantastic.
My pleasure, April. Thank you for having me on.
All right, friends, stick around for a little bit. I have a few more things that I need to get out there, a couple resources for you as a result of the conversation that we've had. So give me one sec and be back and we'll dive into those. All right, friends, thanks so much for hanging out. I have a couple, actually three resources that I want to make you aware of if you are interested in going deeper in this topic. But before I do, I just want to give a giant shout out to this week's guest. Thank you, Erin, so much for such a thoughtful conversation and for sharing so much of your research and so much of your work with us. It was just so helpful. I want to talk about a few things. One, you know, we've talked a lot about how passion, in this episode, we've talked about how passion isn't something that you should solely get at work, that you can expand the places where you experience passion and where you feel engaged and where you have meaningful interactions and activities beyond just what you do at work. But that doesn't necessarily mean you need to feel disengaged all the time. Now, there are a lot of ways to feel engaged at work, and one of them involves cultivating a sense of flow. So if you've heard about the research on flow before, this is when you are in that state of mind where you lose sense of time, you're completely immersed in what you're doing, and you're really working at that optimal level of your ability level as it relates to the challenge at hand. Now, we've actually put together a blog post called Finding Flow at Work that I have linked in this episode description and on the show notes page that can help you with some tips for how you can create more of those flow moments at work. So no, even if your job isn't one that you are completely passionate about, it doesn't fill your soul to be there, you can still put some really quick and easy tips and tricks in place in order to increase the amount of time that you're spending in flow and increase your opportunities to experience flow while you're at work. So I wanted to make sure that I called out that resource for you. Again, it's linked below. You can just swipe up on your device and click the link, or if you're on our website, you can click the link in the show notes on the show notes page. The second piece that I wanted to mention is something that I mentioned in the episode itself, and it is the book Designing Your Work Life. Again, this was put out by the folks at Stanford in the Life Design Lab. Hello, Kathy Davies. I hope everything is going lovely over there if you're listening. We just love them and the work that they're doing and love collaborating with them. And this book is one that can be so life-changing if you're finding yourself in a place where you need a bit of a boost in terms of your impact cup. Maybe you need a deposit there, or your creativity or expression cup. Maybe you need a deposit there. This book can help you think through how to reframe some of the ways you're thinking about your job and also fill those cups up using your entire life, not just one small facet of it. The book is one, I don't know how to describe it. Yes, it's a book you read, but more than that, it is a book you do. It's full of exercises. And if you're somebody who's feeling a lack of clarity, just disengagement, dissatisfaction with your job, before you throw the trash out, before you make a giant change in your life, go check that book out. Spend, you know, a weekend or two just diving into the exercises in it and see what comes of it. It's worth it to you to spend some time and do a little experimenting before you jump. And finally, we talked a lot about, you know, these new experiences that we're all having as a result of the pandemic and, you know, the great resignation and all of these things. And flexible work arrangements and hybrid work arrangements and working from home are another one of those facets that is something that came out of the pandemic that is likely here to stay. And it is both amazing in some ways, but also creates problems in other ways. So we've got a blog post titled Psych Strength and Flexible Work Arrangements. I'm sorry, it's not a blog post. It is a former episode of the podcast, episode number 318. I've got that linked below as well. If you want to go back and listen to ways to cultivate psych strength around these new work arrangements, again, they create different challenges than ones we've had to solve for in the past. And it just means that we need to learn a new set of skills. So we want to start having that conversation. And if, you know, this conversation around, the great resignation and all the fallout from the pandemic got you thinking in that direction, check out episode 318 for a little bit more. All right, so just as a recap, today we heard from the amazing Erin Seck. We talked about passion and how that relates to our engagement at work and the great resignation and so many pieces to that. So thank you, Erin, so much for an incredible conversation. All of her information is linked below. And if you haven't yet left us a rating or a review on iTunes, if you benefited from this conversation in any way, please leave us a rating and a review. You have no idea how much it helps. And finally, as we close out, let's remember that time is the most non-renewable resource on the planet, and I'm so grateful to each and every one of you who chose to spend some of your precious time with me today. I'm Dr. April Seifert, and I will see you next week.